desegregation pushes that began during the civil rights era peaked in the 80s, and now they've been eroded as Brown v. Board has been eroded.
So you've done this series for Epics Network. Where can people see it?
Well, the easiest way to see the whole series is to go to epix.com, epix.com/free trial. It's a premium cable channel like HBO and Showtime. You have to subscribe, but actually you can stream the whole thing online, and actually right now you can do it for free.
This is incredible and explosive, and to be here in the midst of the election season raising all of these issues. We're going to continue the conversation, and we'll post online at democracynow.org. Sally Granatstein, Rick Rowley, and Lucian Reed, an astounding series you have done. I was just at the big opening for the one on housing in New York. You'll be, Rick, today at NYU at 6 o'clock as you show another part of the series. It's called America Divided, and that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nardina Guster, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much.
The time is 5 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Friends of Noise Benefits Show on Sunday, October 16th at 5:30 p.m. at Mississippi Studios in Portland. Friends of Noise formed to create more opportunities for youth to produce, perform, and gather at all-ages music shows and raise awareness for the need of an all-ages venue. Performing at this benefit will be Explode Into Colors, Wampire, and Hugo Berlin. Again, that's Friends of Noise Benefit Show, Sunday, October 16th at 5:30 p.m. at Mississippi Studios, 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Progressive Spirit. This week, I speak with Larry Hurtado, professor of early Christian origins. He discusses why Christianity was so weird in its time and how its weirdness came to define the normalcy of religion today. His book is Destroyer of the Gods, Early Christian Distinctiveness in the Roman World. Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit. Hi, this is...
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland. Presenting a forum on Portland and the Multnomah County ballot measures on Monday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More information can be found at lwvpd.org. And now for your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City Council has closed public comment on the controversial new police union contract and pushed back a final vote of approval.
The conflict over the disputed territory of Kashmir is heating up between India and Pakistan.
And we'll take an in-depth look at one of Portland's homeless advocacy and social service organizations, Outside In.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 6th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Yesterday's meeting in the Portland City Council was canceled amid a large protest against a new contract between the City Council, between the City and the Police Union, the Portland Police Association. Two protesters were arrested in the early afternoon. Mayor Charlie Hells rescheduled the meeting for this afternoon with limited physical access for the public. Protesters with Don't Shoot PDX arrived at City Hall intending to occupy the building yesterday. By 2:30 p.m., the building was on lockdown. Protesters estimated that about half of Portland's police officers were on the scene, as well as a contingent from Homeland Security. At around 3 p.m. yesterday, KBOO News Director Lisa Loving spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch, who was present at City Hall. At the time, the building was still in lockdown and the council's revised schedule was unclear.
Dan, give us your sense of what happened at City Hall today. And again, have you ever seen anything like this? What's going on down there?
Well, the mayor was supposed to be continuing the hearing about the police association contract that started last week. He had introduced an amendment last week to convene a stakeholders group to review the body camera policy that they have attached to the contract. It's actually not part of the union contract. And he had told the public that there was no further public testimony, even though the original item we were testifying on last week had been amended. So people were anxious and they wanted to testify. A previous item about housing came up and he didn't allow public testimony on that. And a community member shouted out and wanted to speak, and he excluded that community member, which led to other community members getting very upset, and then he shut down the whole council meeting. And to make a long story short, they shut down the meeting from 11:15 a.m. until almost 1:30 p.m. when they announced that they're postponing the whole council agenda from today until 1 p.m. Thursday, October 6th, at which point they will have a council hearing with limited public access. And what I was told is that means people are going to be going into the chambers one at a time. I've never seen anything like this in 24 years going to city council meetings. They actually locked us into city council chambers while the mayor was figuring out what to do. They originally told us that we had to leave, and then they locked the doors and told us and put police officers at the doors. And I had to leave to do something, and when I came back, they said I couldn't go back in. Then I further found out that the building itself was locked down, that the same thing applied, that if you left City Hall, you couldn't return back in unless you were a city employee. The people that were enforcing this included a large number of Portland police officers who, you know, part of the point of this union contract is they're saying they're very short-staffed. About half the Portland Police Bureau was in City Hall to attend to this, the quote-unquote disruption of the meeting. And the Department of Homeland Security, which I do not understand still what their jurisdiction was in trying to stop people from testifying at a city council meeting.
So we are at a time in the history of the United States when an entire social movement has emerged around police violence and police accountability. Of course, it's not just here. It's all around the United States. But what makes Portland different from the rest of the United States is that we're considered to be the whitest city in the United States. I want to ask, have you seen anything like this in other parts of the country? Is there any frame of reference we have for what we should be doing now compared to, like, say, other people that have been in a similar situation?
Well, I understand the confusion because there's a lot of moving pieces here. There are other cities where city council meetings have been interrupted or attempted to be shut down. And I know in LA, the Black Lives Matter group down there has shut down the police commission meetings a couple of times. Those are public meetings there. And certainly there's frustration that the policymakers are not listening to what you're saying, this growing movement in the post-Ferguson world that says police accountability is crucial for the community to trust its police. On Tuesday afternoon, the mayor contacted all the neighborhood associations in the city with individually crafted messages from different staff people asking them to write in to support the union contract. That's how scared he is about the movement pushing back against this contract that he's desperately, with one day left before this hearing, trying to get neighborhood associations. And of course, the neighborhood associations have to go back to their members and vote, and they don't know what's in the union contract. But he's playing this as we need more police on the streets. You have crime in your neighborhood. Don't you want more cops? And I find that to be, disingenuous, for one thing. Just because they're offering more money doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get more officers. But the worst of it was one of the aides sent to one of the neighborhood associations the following sentence. First he says, We understand that people have been speaking out loudly for the need for reform in this current political climate. And he says, that is good and helpful. Then he wrote, what is not good nor helpful is that some of these advocates have seized on this new police union contract as, quote, the problem here, and are urging City Council not to approve it. So somebody from the mayor's office is actively disrespecting the concerns of the not only the local version of the Black Lives Matter movement, but Portland Cop Watch and our allies who are, you know, tangentially part of that movement, if we're not part of Don't Shoot Portland itself, you know, we're involved in the same issues and struggle, and they're saying that we are seizing on the contract to saying that we have a problem here, as though our concerns that there's not enough accountability measures being added to the contract is not a valid argument. So we went back around to some of the neighborhood associations that we know, and if anybody out there listening is part of, especially sitting seated on a board of a neighborhood association, and you got one of these emails, our message is more police and more accountability are not mutually exclusive. Let's wait for a contract that gives us both.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Today's city council meeting was tense, but it went off without yesterday's fireworks. The council severely limited the number of speakers allowed to comment on the police union contract. This led to a number of activists, including Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and including Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland. They signed up to speak on a different item, which was the purchase of a large crane. This led to a surreal exchange, such as this one, as an example, between an activist and members of the council.
If you are Black and speak against bridge cranes, SWAT teams are called. When the only weapon...
And you're off topic.
You're okay.
It's a purchase question. That's all. Should we or shouldn't we?
Should you or shouldn't we? Well, I was listening to the testimony, and I thought how great it was that he got to have a voice, that he got to speak about this bridge crane. And I was trying to understand, how do you get a voice? How do you say what you find is important, especially when you're a marginalized group? Doesn't seem like he was, because he looked like
Please
a lot of y'all.
Please address the item at hand, the purchase.
Yeah, the bridge crane, right, exactly.
The council ended up voting unanimously to close public comment on this contract and to conduct a second reading before voting on it.
Oregon's junior senator Jeff Merkley and Minnesota Senator Al Franken appeared at the Wells Fargo building in downtown Portland today to call for a federal investigation into the retail banking giant. Wells Fargo was recently fined by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for the widespread creation of bank accounts without customer knowledge. Wells Fargo has fired 5,300 low-level employees since then, though the unapproved accounts were opened as part of a company-wide top-down sales strategy. Despite claiming, quote, full responsibility for the scandal, Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf has not resigned or fired any high-level employees. Merkley and Franklin's open letter to Attorney General Loretta Lynch demands a criminal investigation of Wells Fargo. Senior Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has also signed onto the letter, as well as 11 other senators, none of them Republicans. This morning in downtown Portland, Merkley read part of the letter for the press.
If a bank teller takes a handful of bills from a cash drawer, that teller is going to be charged with theft, and they're probably going to end up in jail. But a senior executive who oversees a massive fraud that implicates thousands of employees and costs customers millions of dollars can hide behind an army of lawyers and corporate policies that diffuse accountability and often walk away scot-free.
That was Oregon's junior senator Jeff Merkley in downtown Portland this morning.
Well, the embattled Dakota Access Pipeline is about 87% complete within the state of North Dakota. This is according to a September progress report delivered by the company to the state's Public Service Commission. There's been a large protest movement led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe that has so far prevented the pipeline from crossing the Missouri River. Also, protest movements have sprung up further down the planned course of the pipeline. This pipeline will run through South Dakota and Iowa before connecting with an existing pipeline infrastructure in southern Illinois in the town of Patoka. This morning, Air Cascadia host Chris Andre spoke with Ed Fallon, an activist in Iowa, about the ongoing efforts against the pipeline there. Although the pipeline's planned route bisects the state from the northwest corner to the southeast, it will then cross the Mississippi River into Illinois.
Welcome Ed back to the show today. Despite the fact that he's recovering from a pretty serious eye injury, he's joining us today. Thanks so much for this, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
It's wonderful to have you back. So Iowa has never been known as an activist state. So feelings are running pretty high there, I would imagine. And I wondered
We might disagree with that assessment.
Good. Please do.
Yeah, there's been lots of activism over the years here, but it's really coming together in a very pointed way on this pipeline problem because it's uniting folks who may not have worked together in the past, landowners and farmers and people who defend property rights and, of course, environmentalists and people concerned about the climate. So it's bringing a lot of different forces together.
So what's happening there with Vole, Iowa?
Well, there's lots of things going on all across the state right now. There are individual teams of people called BATS, bold action teams, who are going out and trying to block construction wherever they find it. Right now, the biggest presence is at the Mississippi River. Because the pipeline company can come in and they can get a particular stretch of land destroyed and pipe in the ground pretty quick. But the river crossings are huge. And, of course, the Army Corps of Engineers has prevented Dakota Access from crossing the Missouri River by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. But they're letting them go ahead with the Mississippi crossing, which to us is ridiculous. If the Missouri River's and their waters are important, the Mississippi River water should be important as well.
What are we talking about there as far as the distance that they plan to cross?
Well, it's got to be nearly a mile. It's a pretty wide river.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't imagine this, from an engineering point of view, how this can be seen as a safe and secure way of transporting oil. I mean, they're going way down. They're going and then across this river, this great depth and this great length. And, when oil's flowing through that, is there any way to monitor it safely? When there's a break, you'll know there's a break because there'll be plumes of oil floating downstream, It's appalling that they think this makes any sense at all.
It's hard to. They haven't presented any arguments on that nature and that side of things. I have not seen reports on this regarding safety or how well this is being thought out. Have you heard of any other similar projects that went forward and did so with safety and relative success?
Well, what we hear about is lots of other pipeline breaks on the Yellowstone River and the Kalamazoo and lots of other places. And so it's just a matter of time before this one breaks, and it's likely to break, of course, at the Mississippi River or Missouri or some other river crossing. But, of course, it's not a done deal yet. We're still fighting this. Our Native allies have effectively stopped it from happening in North Dakota, and we're fighting as hard as we can. My first action on this was back in March of last year when I walked 400 miles along the pipeline route, starting from where the protests are now focused on the Mississippi River. And right now, today, what's happening there, there's been an encampment. It all started with one gal named Jessica Resnicek, who pitched a tent in the pathway of the vehicles and was arrested. And when they let her out of jail, she came back and pitched her tent again and was arrested again. And that camp has grown from her to 20 or so tents, with hundreds of people showing up on the weekends and 44 being arrested a couple weekends ago. And right now the local officials have said they're going to evict the camp. And so we're kind of waiting to see what might happen on that today. Yeah, I just learned that the state patrol has been called out. And so there could be more arrests happening soon with people being removed from the encampment. But I just got off the phone with one of the organizers and they're committed to continuing the action. And they're encouraging everybody who can to come down to the Mississippi River this coming Saturday to be a part of the next phase of direct action.
Thanks again for this. My guest has been Ed Fallon with Fallon Forum in Bold, Iowa. Thanks again, Ed.
That was KABU's Chris Andre speaking with Ed Fallon on this morning's Air Cascadia.
With millions of gallons of oil traveling across the United States each day, the question looms, just how safe is this? KBOO News did some research. For more, we go to KBOO producer Sam Bowman.
There are four major ways oil is shipped around the world: by train, pipeline, trucks, and supertankers. KBOO reporter Al Kahn took a look at each, and here's what he found. Thousands of trains, most with more than 100 rail cars, move across U.S. rail lines each year, carrying more than 100 million barrels of oil per day. These trains are not subject to the more stringent restrictions placed on other hazardous materials and are allowed to move through the heart of major cities. The last few years, as rail lines have fallen into disrepair and the amount of oil being shipped within the United States has risen, dozens of accidents have occurred, resulting in oil spills and occasional fires. As for pipelines, there are over 160,000 miles of oil pipelines in the U.S. alone. On average, there are more than 300 incidents per year of pipeline failure, causing more than 3 million gallons of oil to spill each year. Large tanker trucks have the capacity to haul as much as 10,000 gallons of oil. Because these trucks have a higher center of gravity than most others, they suffer a higher risk of rollover accidents, which usually will cause a major spill. Theoretically, the safest method of transport is by ocean-bound supertanker. The world has almost 2,400 oil tankers on the oceans at any given time. The largest of these can carry up to 168 million gallons of oil. Although supertanker oil spills are rare, when they do happen, the effects are disastrous. The worst supertanker spill in history was off the coast of Trinidad in 1979. The tanker Atlantic Empress was caught in a tropical storm and collided with another vessel and lost 90 million gallons of oil. This was the largest oil spill in history, not related to stationary drilling or warfare. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman. This information was compiled by KBOO reporter Al Kahn.
Do you remember voting for the homecoming king and queen back in high school? Remember how annoying it was to watch all the popular kids get the crown year after year? Well, the students at Hillsborough High have decided to end the old homecoming court tradition in an effort to better unite their school community. This last week, students were notified of change, which did not sit well with the whole student body, but was generally supported. In addition to wanting to eliminate the popularity contest, students also were addressing the restrictive nature of gendered titles for students who may identify differently.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth at 5:45. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And at 7, it'll be Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around activism and organizing in the local Black African community. Tomorrow's weather will be wet and cold, with a high of 62, a low of 56. A quarter of an inch of rain is expected to fall during the day. On this day in history, in 1973, Syria and Egypt launched a surprise attack against Israel in the Golan Heights and the Suez Canal areas, respectively, leading to the Yom Kippur War. 8 years later, to the day, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was assassinated by members of the group Islamic Jihad during an official commemoration of Egypt's attack on the Suez. And the quote for today is from civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer, born today in 1917. She said, "With the people, by the people, for the people." I crack up when I hear that. I say, "With the handful, for the handful, by the handful," because that's what really happened.
It's 5:23, time for a daily commentary from Jem Hightower.
Stumpf is a German adjective that means someone is obtuse, slow on the uptake, imperceptive, stupid. Ironically, it also happens to be the surname of Wells Fargo's CEO. who is now mired in the most shameful banking scandal yet. For 7 years or so, John Stumpf has presided over a venal bank policy, pressuring Wells Fargo's retailing employees into systematically stealing from particularly vulnerable, low-income customers of the bank. During this time, he padded his own fortune with more than $100 million in personal pay. When this mass ripoff was recently exposed, Stumpf, the big boss getting the big bucks to be in charge, pleaded ignorance. In an act of what Senator Elizabeth Warren called gutless leadership, he publicly blamed the corrupt corporate culture on thousands of the bank's low-level employees. But the chief was not the only Stumpf at Wells Fargo. Where were its board members, who are empowered and duty-bound to set, monitor, and assure ethical corporate behavior from the top down? For 7 years, this 15-member board of governance sat idle, apparently incurious about their corporation's flagrant, widespread thievery, even after a 2013 report by the LA Times exposed it. Far from investigating and clamping down, the board kept shoveling multi-million dollar bonuses at Stumpf and other top executives. Bear in mind that this is a powerhouse board made up of top executives from other corporations, former government financial officials, and big-time academics. And they are extremely well paid to be diligent, getting up to $400,000 a year to keep Wells Fargo honest. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's at work is the ethical rot of America's entire corporate system, a Stumpf system that steals from the many to further enrich the few, buying off the integrity of those who run it.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Untold numbers of American workers are facing an illegal, systematic imposition of forced arbitration agreements from employers that strip workers of their legal rights. These are presented to workers as conditions of employment, and the practice is widespread. But these are illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. Jennifer Fultz was fired from her job with Alorica for refusing to sign one of these illegal arbitration agreements. She's fighting back with a labor attorney in a case filed with the National Labor Relations Board, and she's determined to get justice. And she's urging other workers who are confronted with these forced arbitration documents to fight back, too.
If you're an employee and you feel that your rights are being violated, don't hesitate to stand up. Don't hesitate to reach out to an employment attorney or research what's going on within your district, what's legal and what's not legal. And because I, as being an employee, already had a sense of what was right and what was wrong, even though the job has fired me, there is going to be some type of justice that's going to happen. If you're an employee and you feel that your rights are going to be violated, stand up.
Jennifer says she had 30 minutes to sign the illegal arbitration agreement before she was fired. A sudden choice between keeping her rights or keeping her job.
Being a single mom of an 11-year-old child and having to make that decision of giving away my rights or keeping my job and saying hush, hush, it just felt wrong. I feel completely wounded by everything. I feel like they wronged me in so many ways, firing me because I was protecting my employment rights.
Harvard dining hall workers, represented by Unite Here Local 26, are on strike. They say the strike will continue until they get a fair agreement. The workers want to be paid at least $35,000 a year, and they want affordable health care. The striking workers have widespread student support. Harvard Medical School students, graduate students at Harvard Law School, Harvard Divinity School, and Harvard School of Public Health have all pledged support. The workers met 19 times to bargain with Harvard's administration before striking. The Economic Policy Institute says that African Americans are being paid less than whites at every educational level. This wage gap persists no matter the level of educational attainment by African Americans. EPI says since 1979, the gaps between black and white workers have actually grown the most among educated workers with a bachelor's degree or higher. EPI says to close this gap, more consistent enforcement of anti-discrimination laws is needed, as well as greater transparency within companies on pay, by race, ethnicity, and gender.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Increased storm activity and severity have been linked to climate change, as have increased ocean temperatures. Now predictions of catastrophic damage to the world's largest coral reef's ecosystem, Australia's Great Barrier Reef, have come true. With sea temperatures on the rise, a massive portion of the reef is losing its pigment in a process known as coral bleaching. But it's not just an issue of color, it's an issue of survival. With 93% of the reef already distressed from a recent global bleaching event, the coral's prospects of recovery seem grim, and the world could be seeing the worst of it this month. Georgia Clark with Free Speech Radio News has this report.
One of the world's seven natural wonders, the Great Barrier Reef, is in crisis. Sea warming that caused extensive damage to the more than 1,400-mile-long reef earlier this year could now be hindering the coral's ability to reproduce in a process known as spawning. Tourism and Stewardship Director of the Great Barrier Reef Marine Protection Authority, Dr. Roger Beeden, says that the March bleaching was the most significant mass bleaching event seen since 2006.
What we know from previous bleaching events both in Australia and around the world is that when corals are stressed, it can reduce their capacity to produce their larvae, and that can have an impact upon the mass spawning event. What could well happen this year is in the areas where there was severe damage, we could actually see a reduction in the quality and the abundance of spawn that's produced.
To get a better picture of the current condition of the Great Barrier Reef, NASA has launched a two-month-long aerial assessment. Mr. Eric Hochberg is the principal investigator of the NASA Coral Mission.
The idea of the mission is to survey reefs in their present state and relate their condition to the previous environmental conditions. We see what's there right now. We don't see the bleaching event. We see the aftermath. So we'll see a certain amount of coral, and we'll relate that to the temperature conditions of the past and to the wave conditions of the past.
The world's oceans take up more than 90% of the heat created by climate change, resulting in longer periods of higher water temperatures. Corals can handle a certain level of seasonal temperature fluctuation, but not sustained elevated temperatures. According to Dr. Beeden, the recent damage is so great that regrowth could take years, and that's under ideal circumstances.
There's no doubt that in the area where the worst bleaching occurred, so in the far northern part north of sort of Lizard Island, and particularly on the mid-shelf and inshore reefs, it will take several years to get that recruitment, to get that regrowth, to get that recovery well underway.
Beeden says regeneration depends on the spawning of healthy corals, which release fertilised eggs that must then travel along currents to reach damaged coral reefs. Although the East Australian Current is moving away from the most devastated area in the north, Beeden says that local spawning events in these areas are still possible, but that full recovery is not guaranteed. Alarm bells about the prospects of widespread damage to the reef began in 1998, after the first mass bleaching event was recorded. With coral mortality now at 22%, and with the coral's reproductive capabilities inhibited, recovery prospects look grim. And Australia's massive reef is not alone. Researchers say with worldwide water temperatures high for a third year running, local conservation efforts are needed on a global scale. Georgia Clark, FSRN, Sydney, Australia.
Tensions between India and Pakistan over the disputed territory of Kashmir have intensified in recent weeks. Today, the Indian military claimed to have killed seven militants in two separate overnight skirmishes, bringing the death toll to about 90 in this latest round of hostilities. India, which administers the Kashmir region, has also further restricted media in the area, including the popular Kashmir Reader. Shahnawaz Khan is a local journalist in Kashmir with the website Kashmir News spelled N-E-W-Z, and he filed this report with our friends at Free Speech Radio News.
Widespread public protests against Indian rule have rocked Indian administered Kashmir for the last 3 months amid government curfews and shutdowns called by the region's separatists.
We want freedom! We want freedom!
The protests began in early July after government forces killed a young military commander, Burhan Wani. Since then, police and army forces have killed about 90 people and thousands more have been injured. Hundreds of people have lost either one or both eyes, injured by shotguns used by police, which fire a spray of scattershot at crowds, often leaving a single individual with dozens of metal projectiles embedded in their bodies. Shaukat Lone, a resident of Hajin village in North Kashmir, was struck by pellets while working in his orchard.
A protest march was passing by on the main road. We were sitting in our orchard and police and paramilitary came in through the orchards and attacked the village. They vandalized houses, orchards, and paddy stacks, firing pellets which injured my eyes.
Despite two surgeries, Lone has very little chance of regaining vision in his left eye. His right eye escaped with minor injuries. Doctors at the SMHS hospital in Srinagar have treated about 800 patients like Lone since early July.
We never ever had thought in our dreams that we would receive such huge numbers ever.
Dr. Rashid Maqbool is an ophthalmologist at the hospital.
Around 45 patients are those who received bilateral pellet injuries in both the eyes, what I'm saying. So for them, definitely life has changed completely. Most of them are almost blind. Maybe they can perceive light or maybe hand movements in front of their eyes. That's all they can see.
Dr. Maqbool says the prognosis for most of the other patients with eye injuries is not good. Many are left with vision below 20 by 200, the benchmark for legal blindness in the US. The police launched a massive crackdown in the region to put an end to ongoing protest rallies. Thousands of people have been arrested in midnight raids on their homes, many of them slapped with charges under the controversial Public Safety Act, under which they can be jailed without a trial for 6 months. There are frequent reports of forces vandalizing homes, beating residents, and damaging orchards and paddy stocks in the villages. While the intensity of protests has decreased over the weeks, tensions between India and Pakistan have escalated. Both countries claim the whole of Jammu and Kashmir, and each controls part of it divided by a line of control. India accuses Pakistan of provoking the current unrest in the Indian-controlled region, while Pakistan calls the uprising in Kashmir an indigenous freedom movement.
Peace and normalization between Pakistan and India cannot be achieved without a resolution of the Kashmir dispute.
That's Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif last month at the United Nations General Assembly, where he also repeated the call for a UN fact-finding mission to investigate brutalities by Indian forces in the region.
A new generation of Kashmiris has risen spontaneously against India's illegal occupation, demanding freedom from occupation.
A few days earlier, four suspected militants attacked an Indian army base near the line of control in Udi town, killing 19 soldiers. India accused Pakistan of sending in the attackers and vowed revenge. Pakistan denied the allegation and called it a tactic to deflect attention from the unrest and rights violations in Kashmir. Amid calls for a nuclear war from the media and the public, last week, India's Director General of Military Operations, Lieutenant General Rambir Singh, claimed militants were preparing to enter the country.
The Indian Army conducted surgical strikes last night at these launch pads. The operations were basically focused to ensure that these terrorists do not succeed in their design of infiltration and carrying out destruction and endangering the lives of citizens of our country. During these counter-terrorist operations, significant casualties have been caused to the terrorists and those who are trying to support them.
Pakistan denied any such strikes occurred, but did allege that unprovoked shelling on its posts at the line of control killed two of its soldiers. The hot, turbulent summer in Kashmir has brought the subcontinent to a boil, and without serious diplomatic efforts, many here fear the increasing discord will continue to escalate. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imamc.org for Wednesday, October 5th, 2016. Israeli troops take over solidarity ship to Gaza. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, army bulldozers uproot Palestinian lands. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli Air Force and Army fired several shells and missiles on Wednesday, targeting various areas of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli government said that the attack came after an alleged shell was fired from Gaza and hit an open area near Sderot in the Negev. Damage was reported, but no injuries by the Israeli attacks. Earlier on Wednesday morning, Israeli soldiers and Navy ships opened fire targeting Palestinian fishing boats, farmers and shepherds in different parts of the Gaza Strip. Media sources in Gaza have reported that Israeli tanks fired one shell into a Palestinian agricultural land east of Al-Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City. They added that soldiers stationed at military towers in the Nahal Oz base fired many live rounds at farmers and shepherds east of Al-Shuja'iyya neighborhood east of Gaza City. In addition, Navy ships fired many live rounds at fishing boats in a Sudanese area northwest of Gaza City, causing damage and also forcing the fishers to go back to shore. A similar attack was reported targeting many fishing boats near Khan Yunis in the southern part of the coastal region, causing property damage. In related news, an Israeli Air Force pilot died and another was injured on Wednesday as their fighter jet crashed while returning from an air assault on the besieged coastal region, Israeli news sources reported. An Israeli Army spokesperson said that an F-16 fighter jet crashed while landing at the Rimmon Air Base in the Negev Desert. Also on Wednesday, the Israeli Army announced that Navy forces have taken control of the Zaytuna relief ship while on its way to Gaza. According to the Israeli Army, its troops took control of the ship 70 miles off Gaza shoreline. The ship was taken to Ashdod Israeli seaport and all solidarity workers aboard were arrested. Elsewhere, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that Israeli soldiers have kidnapped overnight and early on Wednesday 9 Palestinians, including 2 children, in the occupied West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem. Moreover, several Israeli military vehicles accompanied by armored bulldozers invaded Palestinian lands in Beit Ula town near the southern West Bank city of Hebron and uprooted at least 1.5 acres of Palestinian lands planted with almond trees. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 5th, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imamc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Karen James, Al Khan, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Chris Andre of Air Cascadia and to our friends at Free Speech Radio News. You can find them at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith.
Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday on KBOO, it'll be Democracy Now! At 7 a.m. with Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, host Ani Haynes will speak with Guardian Editor-at-Large Gary Young, who is in the U.S. to report on our presidential election for The Guardian. He is also the author of the forthcoming book about gun violence called Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives. At 9 a.m. tomorrow on Water World, host Kristen Yount reports on water policy in Pakistan, where she recently spent a two-week internship, and on the situation in Detroit and what people can do to protect their drinking water supply. At 10 a.m., it'll be Chris Andre. She'll host Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 a.m., tune in for a Radio Geekly. They're going to dive into a discussion of the progressive movement within geek culture. They'll be chatting about the bending of gender roles, about embracing the LGBTQ and POC communities, and more besides. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support in our recent fall drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute and become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Homelessness is a constant issue in Portland, both on the streets and in arguments over city policy. With a constant focus on what hasn't worked, what must be done, and what can be done, it is easy to overlook the organizations that have been working with the ever-shifting homeless population for years. On today's KBOO News In Depth, KBOO reporter Karen James takes a look at one of those organizations, Outside In, located in Southwest Portland.
Portland's Outside In on 13th